Sam Gracio studied the large iron gate and cement archway as he approached. He could only imagine what awaited him on the other side. A life of slave labor, no doubt. More physical and psychological torture. More torture, likely. But speculating on the future was not his immediate concern. Water was the foremost thing in his mind. Approaching the end of a 17-mile forced march from the coast under the blazing tropical sun, hemmed in by thick jungle and prodded along by Japanese soldiers and their fixed bayonets. He and the nearly 1,000 other prisoners were desperate to get through the gate and into the prison. Yes, they were desperate to get into prison, knowing that the promise of water, cool, clear, refreshing water, awaited them. As forced marches go, Lieutenant Sam Gracio had seen worse. His life as a prisoner of war began with the infamous Bataan Death March. He and approximately 60,000 other American and Filipino soldiers were forced to march the entire length of the peninsula, guarding the western entrance to Manila Bay, from Mariveles in the south to San Fernando in the north, a distance of 65 miles. In his 15 months of experience of war, nothing had come close to the demonic brutality he witnessed in the Bataan Death March. It began the day of their surrender, April 9th, 1942. As they were being searched by their captors, a Japanese soldier found a few crumpled yen in the pocket of an American captain. The Japanese assumed that anyone in possession of Japanese currency, rising sun flags, or any other Japanese items must have taken them from a dead Japanese soldier. Before any of the prisoners could even register what was happening, the captain was forced to his knees and beheaded with a samurai sword. The shock and horror of this incident was vastly amplified by how efficiently and nonchalantly it had all taken place. Clearly, their captors were well experienced in meting out death to anyone at any time, for any reason whatsoever. From that moment forward, torture and death were a constant over the next 5 days and nights. It was a grueling, brutal litany of hunger, thirst, beheadings, shootings, bayonettings, Gracio would later recall. Soldiers who fell or were too weak to continue were shot. Men were bayoneted for trifling offenses, seemingly at random. One of the Japanese guards took a fancy to a ring one of the POWs was wearing and tried to take it off. His attempts proved difficult due to the prisoner's swollen hands, likely a result of a vitamin deficiency or some tropical disease. So the guard held the prisoner's hand up against a tree. Now, I realize this is an after-dinner speech, so I'll spare you the gruesome details. But the scene ended with the guard placing the man's ring on his own finger. As the column moved on, prisoners looking back were horrified to see a soldier kill the bleeding man with a bayonet through the stomach. U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Mario Tonelli considered himself lucky. His ring had come off easily enough when the Japanese guard pulled it from his hand. He sure missed that ring. It was his class ring from the University of Notre Dame, class of 1939. Looking at the bare white band on his otherwise deeply tanned hands, his thoughts went back to his playing days and the crisp fall afternoons in Indiana. It was a far cry from the 100-degree heat that kept his head bowed, his gaze fixed on the ground to avoid eye contact with the enemy soldiers. Suddenly, a pair of shoes entered his field of vision, and with them, a uniform of a Japanese soldier. Their eyes met, and to Tonelli's shock, the officer said in perfect English, "Did any of my men take anything from you?" "Yes," said Tonelli, "my class ring." The officer held out his hand and opened it to reveal Tonelli's ring. He then explained how, as a student at the University of Southern California, he witnessed Tonelli's winning touchdown run against his alma mater in 1937. I know how much this ring means to you, he said, so I wanted to get it back to you. Tonelli slipped the ring into his pocket and vowed he would never be separated from it again. This was the sole act of humanity that Tonelli, Gracio, and their fellow prisoners would receive at the hands of the Japanese. In San Fernando, they were herded like cattle into hot metal boxcars for the one-hour train trip to Capaz. There, they were stuffed in like sardines, so tight they couldn't even sit down. Dysentery was rampant, the stench unbearable. Men fainted, and some died on the way. Afterward, those still surviving were marched another 9 miles to Camp O'Donnell. It is estimated that 1,000 Americans and 9,000 Filipinos died on the Bataan death march. In Camp O'Donnell, the brutal, inhumane treatment continued. One historian documented their daily fare. The prisoners were fed tiny portions of lugao, a pastry rice gruel full of floor sweepings and weevils that tasted like glue, plus occasional helpings of rotten camotes, mango beans, and other cast-off vegetables. Ravenous men were soon reduced to stealing food, scheming other prisoners for their rations, and scrambling to catch grasshoppers, rats, and stray dogs. Death became a constant companion. On some days, they buried more than 100 of their fellow soldiers. Anyone trying to escape was shot. Then, the Japanese came up with another plan. If a prisoner tried to escape, not only would he be shot, but 5 or 10 other men would be executed as well. So they gave up thoughts of escape and turned their minds instead to survival in the enemy's hands. And that required a determination of steel, that no matter what, they would survive. In time, these men, those that were determined to survive, began to recognize each other, or rather to recognize that spark of determination that glazed in their eyes. Sadly, they also saw men in whom that ember of hope faded and at last went out. Lieutenant Gracio had a friend who was afflicted with elephantiasis, a tropical parasitic disease that made him horribly disfigured and left him in constant pain. Sam, he confided, every night as I go to sleep, I pray to God that I won't wake up the next morning. Not long thereafter, his prayer was answered. Another soldier, Marine First Lieutenant Austin Schaffner, was approached by a fellow Marine. Schaff, he said quietly, it's easy to die. What do you mean, easy? Demanded Schaffner. Last night I was awake when Joe died. It was real peaceful. No struggle, no pain. Hey, knock it off, replied Schaffner. That's no way to talk. You've got to live, boy, live. Think about your wife and kids. Schaff, the man replied, we're not going to make it. You know that. Every day just prolongs the agony. It's senseless, Schaff. I'm going to die. And he did. Schaffner helped bury the man 4 days later. Those determined to live found ways to mentally insulate themselves from the horrors around them and to nurse that flame of hope, determined it would never be extinguished. Each man found his own source of strength. For Tonelli, it was his Notre Dame class ring. Once he arrived at O'Donnell, he placed the ring inside a small tin and hid it under the barracks. Each night, he snuck down under the building and pulled it out. Holding it in his hands, he turned it just enough to read the inscription in the reflected searchlights of the guard towers. It was the motto of the university, Vita Dulcedo Spes. Vita Dulcedo Spes. Vita Dulcedo Spes. Over and over, he prayed those three words, our life, our sweetness, our hope. Renewed, he placed the ring back in its tin, rehid it, and left with another strength to face another day. Tonelli, Schaffner, and Gracio spent a total of 60 days in Camp O'Donnell. During that two-month period, they helped bury 1,100 fellow Americans and 14,000 Filipino soldiers. Let that sink in. According to U.S. Army records, in the 8 months between May 1942 and its closure in January 1943, Camp O'Donnell witnessed the deaths of 26,000 of the 50,000 men imprisoned there. After O'Donnell, they were moved to another POW camp, the infamous Kabanatuan, and the hunger, torture, disease, and death moved with them. They sometimes buried up to 50 or 60 men in a single day in mass unmarked graves. One day, a prisoner escaped. The Japanese decided to execute 5 men in retaliation, picked at random from a group of 100 prisoners. Marine First Lieutenant Mike Dobrovich of Minnesota watched helplessly as his own brother was among those selected. The days passed into weeks, and the weeks into months. Many of the men in Kabanatuan were little more than walking skeletons. Others had somehow managed to keep enough meat on their bones to be considered for work detail by the Japanese. A rumor spread of a labor camp in the southern Philippines where more men were needed for farm work. Gracio wasn't sure whether he should volunteer. At least in Kabanatuan, he knew how bad it was. Perhaps it would be even worse somewhere else, out of the frying pan into the fire. It was his commanding officer, First Lieutenant Ed Diaz, that changed his mind. "Nothing could be worse than here," he told Gracio. So the two of them, along with Tonelli, Schaffner, Dobrovich, and nearly 1,000 other prisoners, signed up. They were marched out of Kabanatuan at the end of October 1942 and loaded onto the Eri Maru, a decrepit cargo ship, for the 10-day voyage to the island of Mindanao. And that is how Lieutenant Sam Gracio found himself here, marching through the gates of yet another prison. The sign on the archway read, "Davao Penal Colony," but it may as well have said, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." It is impossible for us today to comprehend the horrors those men lived through at the hands of a sadistic enemy under the rising sun. How could we? Surrounded with all the comforts of modern life, there is nothing in our realm of experience that can even remotely compare to the constant brutality they endured. So how are we to draw lessons for today from experiences so drastically different from our own? In fact, it was a reflection on the contrast between the horrors of life in the Japanese POW camps and the comforts of modern life that brought the story of Sam Gracio to my mind. The reflection that it is thanks to the efforts of his efforts and those of his comrades that we now have the freedom to live our lives as we see fit, freedom to practice our religion, freedom to raise our children in the knowledge and service of God. Thanks to those men, we have freedom rather than its opposite, imprisonment, confinement, restriction of movement, in a word, lockdown. As a student of history, alarm bells went off in my mind when I first heard that word enter our national discourse in the spring of 2020. What do you mean, lockdown? What do you mean everyone has to hunker down at home and not venture outside? Lockdown for a pandemic? We have, or had, a pandemic preparedness plan in place. And it didn't include lockdown. The plan was very clear. In case of a highly transmissible and deadly pathogen, identify and protect the vulnerable, quarantine the sick, and allow healthy people to continue life as normal as possible, or as close as possible as they could. That was the plan, carefully developed over the past century. But in March 2020, that plan was thrown out the window and replaced with carefully crafted slogans, custom designed to fit on bumper stickers, on billboards, and into sound bites for the talking heads on TV. No, we were told, 2 weeks to flatten the curve. It's just 2 weeks, a minor inconvenience. After all, it's for the greater good. Then 30 days to slow the spread. This is what we have to do. Remember, we're all in this together. After all, it's for the greater good. Each new slogan chipped away at our basic human rights and freedoms, as if they weren't really ours to begin with, as if they were things that the state allowed us to enjoy on a temporary basis, as opposed to inalienable rights endowed by our Creator by virtue of His design in creating man in His image and likeness. Rights preserved for us by the heroic sacrifices of our forebears. So what happened? How was it that people so readily complied and gave up their freedoms without even asking why? Did people really fall for those goofy videos out of China of people falling over in the street, afflicted with a really painful case of bad acting? Or was it the guilt trip? You're going to kill grandma. Or was it something else? How did COVID hysteria take hold so quickly and so pervasively throughout society? Dr. Matthias Desmet, a clinical psychologist at Ghent University, specializes in the fields of personality structures and group dynamics. There is one particular phenomenon in group dynamics that psychologists have termed mass formation. Dr. Desmet has studied various events in history where this phenomenon took place. Entire populations were overcome with what might be described as a society-wide state of hypnosis, where individual identity was subsumed by a group dynamic and substituted herd instinct for individual critical thinking and decision-making. There are many examples of mass formation in societies going back many centuries, but more recent examples include the French Revolution, the Communist Revolutions in Russia and China, and the rise of Nazism in Germany in the 1930s. As an expert in the field, Dr. Desmet instantly recognized COVID hysteria as a mass formation event occurring in real time in 2020. He explains that mass formation requires four pre-existing conditions which coalesce from emergent trends in a society. These four conditions are: 1, social isolation and loneliness; 2, a sense of meaninglessness in one's daily life; 3, a lot of free-floating anxiety, insecurity and angst that is not specifically linked to a single identifiable root cause; and 4, underlying frustration and aggression, a natural outcome of the first three conditions. When these four pre-existing conditions are in place and shared by a sufficiently large cohort of the population, the stage is set for a mass formation event. Dr. Desmet explains, under these conditions, the population is sensitive to a very specific phenomenon. If, under these conditions, a narrative is distributed through the mass media indicating an object of anxiety and at the same time providing a strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, something extremely strange happens. All this free-floating anxiety connects to the object of anxiety presented in the narrative, and people are willing to participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety. And that in itself leads to the most important aspect of mass formation. Because everybody participates in the same strategy, a new social bond emerges and people feel less isolated. But because the fourth characteristic, all this frustration and aggression, is now directed at the group who doesn't want to participate in the mass formation. Sound familiar? Dr. Desmet continues, because all this free-floating anxiety is connected to this mental representation of the object of anxiety, it seems as if the only part of reality that still exists is the object of anxiety and the strategy to deal with it. And that explains why it has the same psychological effects as hypnosis. Because in hypnosis, that's exactly what happens. Someone focuses the attention of someone else on one specific point of reality, and once he succeeds in doing this, it is as if the rest of reality does not exist anymore. The focusing of attention is an extremely strong psychological mechanism which explains also that during mass formation, authoritarian leaders can take everything away from people without them noticing. But we need not lose heart. Dr. Robert Malone, a vocal critic of the COVID narrative, observed that in his experience there was one group in society that seemed particularly resistant to mass formation, and that group of people is those who are strongly religious. We saw this in many faith communities during COVID. For example, the Amish come to mind. They sure didn't buy into the narrative. And thankfully, we saw this among our own traditional Catholic parishes as well. One reason for this, I think, goes back to those pre-existing conditions. A person who believes in God knows their life is not meaningless. This is the single central point of our Catholic faith. Question number 3 in the Baltimore Catechism. Why did God make us? God made us to show forth his goodness and to share with us his everlasting happiness in heaven. And if you truly believe and practice the teachings of Christ, you will not have free-floating anxiety in your life. Do not be anxious, saying, "What shall we eat?" or "What shall we drink?" or "What shall we put on?" For your Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things shall be given you besides. On reflection, COVID really did teach us to be wary of the irrational fears that fed it, and to be on guard against those who would manipulate that fear to create the type of population-wide hysteria that resulted in our most fundamental rights being taken away. On reflection, this is precisely how Imperial Japan became such a force for evil in the world. The ruling elite succeeded in essentially hypnotizing pretty much the entire population, creating a fanatical dedication to an irrational worldview. And because of that fanaticism, millions of people died in China, Korea, Formosa, Hong Kong, Singapore, the Philippines, and beyond. It is a lesson we can never forget. The tinkle of the small bell in Sam Gracio's hand took him back in time to a better place. At least the camp commander in the Davao penal colony, Depakal for short, allowed them to have mass. As Father Carberry intoned the Sanctus, Gracio's mind transported him back to his days as an altar boy, 10 years and 7,000 miles away. The small bamboo chapel was a far cry from St. Aloysius Church back in Spokane. He was grateful to his parents for his Catholic faith, and he was grateful to the nuns back at St. Aloysius Grade School for teaching him his prayers and instilling in him a love for the Mass. Spokane had been on his mind more and more these days. Christmas was particularly hard, as he recalled the many happy holidays of the past with his family. But when those Red Cross packages arrived a month later with those familiar name brand labels from the U.S., he thought his heart would burst with longing for home. One way or the other, he thought to himself, I've got to get out of here. I've got to escape. But it wasn't just sentimental memories of home that fed that desire for freedom. Life in Depakal was not as horrific as Kabanatuan, but it was still a POW camp. Every day was a grueling marathon of work from sunup to sundown. It was, after all, a slave labor camp. And having very little in the way of medical supplies and being in such weakened conditions from malnutrition, what would normally be a passing infection might very well be a death sentence for the prisoners. Being constantly harassed by mosquitoes in the fields, the men were frequently stricken with malaria and dengue fever. If he didn't escape, Sam Gracio figured, he would be dead in a few months' time. And so it was that when his commanding officer, Ed Dias, mentioned in mid-February that he and Austin Schaffner were formulating an escape plan Gratio nearly jumped out of his skin. When do we go? Right now? Sure. By this point, he figured even if they got caught and were executed, so what? It would only be faster than staying on to expire of disease or starvation. But as excited as he was, he knew they would have to plan and prepare, and that would take time. The plan came together slowly over many weeks. They would need supplies, clothing, food, canteens, cooking gear, a compass, a map, bolo knives to cut their way through the jungle. But what about the swamp? One of the unique things about Dapakal was that it was largely unfenced. Situated in the middle of the jungle, the Japanese figured the thick forest foliage surrounding the camp was sufficient to keep the men in. Anyone foolish enough to venture into the jungle would surely never make it out alive. Poisonous insects and venomous snakes posed a lethal deterrent, and impassable thickets of sword grass presented a wall as impenetrable as the barbed wire fence of Kabanatuan. And anyone who somehow managed to penetrate more than a mile or two into the jungle would then find himself confronted with a crocodile-infested swamp. And if they managed to get all the way through the swamp and out to the coast, what then? They would still be in enemy-controlled territory. To truly escape, they would have to commandeer a boat and sail to Australia. Well, this was going to take some planning and supplies and more men. But which men? They needed to be very careful about who they brought into their clandestine group. The more they included, even under strict secrecy, the more risk that someone might slip up and their captors would uncover their plans. And so, slowly, meticulously, the escape party grew. They would need Marines with survival training, Schaffner, Mike Dobrovich, and their friend Jack Hawkins. They would need someone to sail the ship they hoped to find at the coast. Navy Commander Melvin McCoy fit the bill. Diaz and Gratio had a fellow Army Air Corps friend named Leo Bolins they brought into the company. That made seven. West Point graduate Steve Melnick and two enlisted men, Bob Spielman and Paul Marshall, rounded the troop out to 10. That seemed about the right number. But they also needed someone who knew the area and who could draw them a map. Sure, the Marines could lend their survival skills, but without local knowledge of the jungle and the swamp, they wouldn't have a chance. They needed a resident guide. And Sam Gratio had someone in mind. As the name suggests, the Davao Penal Colony had originally been a penitentiary. Although the Japanese had converted it into a POW camp, they kept on the hundreds of hardened criminals that had been imprisoned there to supplement their slave labor force. Although kept in a separate part of the compound from the American POWs, the two groups often worked together. It was on one of these occasions that Sam Gratio first met Ben de la Cruz. His knowledge of English, Tagalog, and a few local dialects would certainly come in handy, as would the first aid training he acquired working in the prison hospital. But when Sam approached Ben about joining the escape party, he had one condition. His best friend, Victor Humarong, had to come along too. When Sam met Victor, he couldn't believe his luck. Humarong did not speak much English, but he knew the jungle well. Prior to the war, he had worked extensively in the area, helping to build trails through the jungle. He was the perfect guide. So that was it. The group was complete, a dozen men. The plan was set. All the equipment had been painstakingly collected and surreptitiously stashed a short way inside the jungle. And at last, the date was fixed, Sunday, April 4th, 1943. On that day at mid-morning, the men would wander off individually from their respective work details, assemble at the rendezvous point just outside the camp, and work their way through the jungle and around the swamp to the railroad tracks Humarong had sketched from memory on his handmade map. From there, they would follow the railroad line deeper inland in hopes of contacting the former Filipino servicemen who were rumored to be waging guerrilla warfare against the Japanese. Such freedom fighters, the men believed, would surely assist them to complete their escape to Australia. The quest for freedom is one of the most fundamental instincts in man. And conversely, slavery, the denial of freedom, is the end goal of authoritarian regimes like Imperial Japan, or Communist China, or the World Economic Forum. And they will pursue this goal by any means necessary. As we see the COVID mass formation losing its grip on society, the incessant drumbeat of climate change is ramping up. It's the same playbook. Focus all this free-floating anxiety in society upon an object of anxiety and project a narrative to harness and control that collective anxiety to serve a particular political end. The climate change narrative postulates that climate change is destroying the world. Climate change is caused by man, or at least disproportionately impacted by human activity. And we can reverse climate change by changing human behavior. Now, one interesting thing Dr. Desmet observed about mass formation is the narrative that leads to mass formation typically becomes more and more absurd. And people don't seem to notice this, which can be explained, he points out, by recognizing that the people didn't buy into the narrative because it is correct or scientific or accurate, but because it creates this new social bond. And the climate narrative has indeed become more and more absurd, without people even noticing. The narrative went from a new ice age in the 1970s to global warming in the 1990s. People didn't notice. And for decades now, the so-called climate experts have been prophesying the end of the world, predicting that we have only 12 years left to save the planet, or 10 years left. 18 months. Okay, six. As with COVID, the experts' models are a complete fraud. Their fixation on carbon dioxide emissions as the single greatest source of global warming fails to recognize the feedback controls in nature that provide a buffering effect against change rather than an amplifying effect that increases change. One of these is photosynthesis. Carbon dioxide is to plants what oxygen is to mammals. As the concentration of carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, currently about 400 parts per million or 0.04%, we see more abundant plant growth, which in turn serves to temper radiant heat. But the most absurd thing in the climate change narrative is its manifestly false premise that the Earth's climate isn't supposed to change, that our children, grandchildren, and descendants for millennia to come are supposed to experience the exact same climate, the arbitrarily ideal climate, that we experienced in our idyllic childhoods. The briefest, most superficial look at the Earth's climate record proves that this notion is completely absurd. The climate has always changed over the entire course of the Earth's history. And that is the whole point. Climate changes, always has, and always will. And there is nothing we can do about it. The Earth's climate is a highly complex, dynamic system controlled by a multitude of contributing factors, including the sun, first and foremost, and the various aspects of the Earth's planetary motion, such as its revolution around the sun and rotation on its axis, the periodic variations in the Earth's angle of rotation, and modulations of the Earth's orbital path. Collectively, these phenomena produce what are known as Milankovitch cycles, natural cycles in these various aspects of the Sun-Earth dynamic that superimpose on each other over time to induce changes in the Earth's climate from warming to cooling. The entire premise of the new climate change religion and it is a religion, is false, and its narrative is absurd. It's mass formation again, just like COVID. And those COVID lockdowns, oh, were just a dress rehearsal for the coming climate lockdowns. They're just around the corner. You see, the object of anxiety, whether it be COVID or climate, is immaterial. It's the end goal that matters, the advance of a communist, globalist agenda, the imprisonment of the world's population mentally as well as physically under the complete control of a central ruling elite. Oh yes, such an assertion is met with derision among these arrogant elites. Oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist, they scoff. However, such dismissals have to contend with what might be termed the inconvenient truth that this conspiracy is actually quite well documented. It's no theory, it's a fact. And, as the saying goes nowadays, we've got the receipts. 30-some years ago, a tidal shift disrupted the geopolitical landscape. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, followed by the collapse of communism in Russia in 1991. In the wake of these historic events, the globalists had to come up with a new villain, a new object of anxiety to keep people in check. And so the Club of Rome met in 1991 to find that new villain to replace the old Soviet Union. And they settled on climate change. And, inconvenient truth, they documented this plan in a book entitled The First Global Revolution, in which they state, quote, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself," end quote. You see, everything about the climate change religion makes sense once you realize that you are the carbon they want to eliminate. Afternoon, April 4th, 1943. Exhaustion, nausea, diarrhea, and disorientation plagued the 12 escapees. They had been working their way ever so slowly through the dense jungle in the broiling heat, carrying their heavy packs. Two members of the party led in the front, chopping a narrow path through the jungle vegetation with bolo knives. The sharp edges of kogan grass sliced through clothes and fresh flesh indiscriminately. As the afternoon wore on, they had stopped bothering to swat away the mosquitoes. The insect swarms were too thick, and the men were too exhausted. Their escape had started out well enough that morning, extremely well, in fact. Their plan had worked to perfection. Dispersed out on various work details, they had simply wandered further and further from their respective groups, and once out of sight of the guards, made their way to the assigned rendezvous point, a short distance into the jungle at a remote edge of the camp. There, Commander McCoy, the senior-ranking military officer, gave each man his assignment, and they began their trek to freedom. But as the day wore on, the elation of the morning had dissipated. They had progressed only 1,000 feet in the last hour. The heavy packs wore the prisoners down. Given their physical state after months of captivity, it was no wonder that several of them began to feel dizzy in the tropical heat. All the men were hungry and exhausted, and they had made less than 2 miles progress. And not even Humarong knew for certain how many miles lay in front of them. The reality of their predicament was setting in, and along with it, a drenching downpour. McCoy called a halt and ordered the men to make camp for the night. Hopefully, things would go better tomorrow. Their second day started out in much the same way as their first day had ended, with painfully slow progress. But they kept at it, and around midday, their spirits perked up when at last they broke through the tangle of vines onto a fresh trail. But their jubilation was instantly crushed with the realization that the footprints on the trail were their own. They were traveling in circles. Frustrated, exhausted, hot, thirsty, and weak, they fell to the ground. A sense of dejection and despair began creeping in. They had given all they could. They were lost. It was hopeless. It was the Marines that saved the day. They had been talking quietly amongst themselves for the last hour, sensing that something wasn't quite right. It would have been obvious if they could have seen the sun and recognized their direction based on its relative position. But the jungle canopy made that impossible. As the company leader, McCoy had the compass. Sure, he was a trained navigator, but his training dealt with navigating on the open sea, not on land in a dense jungle. Of all the members of the company, only the Marines had had survival training, including land navigation. Schaffner approached McCoy and volunteered to take the lead. McCoy acknowledged that Schaffner was more qualified for the task and handed over the compass. He then pulled out their makeshift map and pointed to where he believed they were, relative to the railroad tracks to the north. The only problem was that from here, the path led straight into the swamp. But there was no choice. They couldn't go around. They didn't know how far out of their way that would take them, and they just didn't have the strength. And they couldn't backtrack to their starting point and proceed by a less challenging route. Going back meant a greater risk of recapture. They had to move forward. They were soon back in the thick of the jungle, cutting their way slowly north. In time, McCoy's estimate of their position proved correct as the ground became softer, then water-clogged, and then a quagmire of mud, stagnant water, fallen logs, and other hazards as they entered the swamp. At each step, their boots sunk in the mud. At each step forward, it took time and patience as they slowly pulled the trailing boot out of the mud and struggled to keep their balance for the next step. They often went out of their way to get to a higher section of ground where they would stop to pull the leeches off their legs, often leaving a trickle of crimson blood in their place. It was only a matter of time before infection would set in. Their progress slowed to a crawl. They had progressed only 50 feet in the last hour. With night approaching and unknown miles still to go, hope faded with the daylight. They grouped up at a cluster of fallen logs and dropped their packs. With night fast approaching, they had to make camp. After a short rest, they began cutting small vines and branches to weave into a makeshift sleeping platform. Suddenly, one of the escapees screamed in pain, and then another. While chopping saplings and vines, someone had inadvertently hit a wasp's nest. And these were not the nuisance yellow jackets that we're familiar with here in North America. These were large, aggressive Asian hornets. And they were very angry. The buzzing swarm descended on the men. Their stings felt like hot daggers. There was no escaping, no recourse, but to jump into the chest-deep swamp and submerge under the fetid water, surfacing for a gulp of air when their lungs were ready to burst. After 30 minutes, the attack had dissipated enough for them to emerge from the water. Exhausted, they pulled off their wet clothing and counted the stings. One of the men had been stung 12 times. As they sat painfully around a small fire for a dinner of corned beef and rice, reality was setting in. They were defeated. Some of the men looked as pale as ghosts. Some already felt the first chills of fever from their infected wounds. McCoy looked like he wouldn't last another day. De La Cruz suspected malaria. They knew what the end would be. They had seen enough of death to know. Hunger, thirst, fever, hallucination would slowly take over. Some caught themselves hallucinating already. They were defeated, and they all knew it. One of them finally voiced what many were feeling. "I'm going to go back and turn myself in." Schaffner stood his ground. Nobody was going back. The Japanese would torture them and kill them in the most horrific way imaginable. They all knew it. Their heads drooped. They were trapped. Retreat was not an option, but none had any strength left to go on. They barely had strength to speak. This was it. They would die here. It was inevitable. Suddenly, there was a violent thrashing sound from a thicket only 50 feet away. They quickly doused to the fire and jumped back into the water. Was it the Japanese? Were they already surrounded? They waited with bated breath, bolos drawn, and waited. Some of the men felt like they were being watched. They listened. Complete stillness. All they heard was silence. It was completely quiet. Too quiet. In fact, they didn't even hear any insects buzzing. Suddenly, Humarong sprang from the water and back onto the platform and, in his excitement, began yelling in Tagalog. The men looked at him in shock and confusion and then at De La Cruz. What was he saying? De La Cruz bolted from the water. Come on, he yelled. Crocodiles! Razor-edged swordgrass, blood-sucking leeches, swarms of mosquitoes carrying malaria and dengue fever, clinging vines that wrapped around their necks, arms, and legs, foul-smelling swamp water filled with parasites, thorns that pierced their dilapidated footwear, stinging wasps, venomous snakes, and now crocodiles? They just could not take any more. They were defeated. This is in no way a comparison, but this list of real threats the escapees faced brings to mind the series of exaggerated threats that we've been told over the last 50 years will end life as we know it. Acid rain, the ozone hole, the new ice age, the Cold War, global warming, West Nile virus, hantavirus, flesh-eating bacteria, nuclear winter, weapons of mass destruction, avian flu, H1N1, Zika virus, climate tipping point, hurricanes, pandemics, El Nino, La Nina, melting ice caps, polar vortex, the end of the Gulf Stream, MERS, SARS, SARS-CoV-2, Delta, Omicron, variants, monkeypox, climate change. As the American scholar H.L. Mencken put it more than 100 years ago, the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. Yes, this endless list of crises is nothing more than a hodgepodge of scare tactics cooked up by the ruling elite to instill fear in the masses as a means to achieve a particular political end. Fear is indeed a potent weapon. Edmund Burke observed, "No passion so effectually robs the mind of all its powers of acting and reasoning as fear." You see, once the political elites have the populace enslaved to fear, they have an unimaginable power to manipulate entire groups of people in ways that would have defied belief if we did not witness it ourselves over the past 3 years. But to what purpose? The short answer is power. They don't want people to govern themselves. They are opposed to democracy, free speech, national sovereignty. They don't want people making decisions for themselves without getting permission from their masters. They want control over every aspect of our lives through central planning and global government. It is that lust for power that inspires the ruling elites and their acolytes to cook up one fear after another, each one more absurd than the last. But any student of history knows, as the French philosopher Voltaire stated, "Truly, whoever can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities." Yes, we've certainly witnessed atrocities over the last 3 years. People arrested in city parks for not wearing a mask. Perfectly healthy people locked in isolation huts in a quarantine facility. People fired from their jobs for exercising their free will. Families kicked off airplanes because their two-year-old could not be compelled to wear a face mask. A 90-year-old with only weeks to live, reaching out for her great-grandchildren, prevented from embracing them and feeling the warmth of their love in her final moments by a plastic sheet. An adult son scolded for leaving his socially distanced chair at his father's funeral to comfort his weeping mother, his own mother. This is evil. George Orwell is most famous for his dystopian novel, 1984. In it, he describes a society ruled by a faceless elite, exercising their power over individuals through a pervasive, creeping control over not only every individual action, but even every individual word, even every thought. Sadly, with each passing day, Orwell has become less a novelist and more a prophet, that dystopian future he envisioned? We are living it. Just look at the actions taken by the ruling elites over the past few years and reflect on the words of George Orwell. But always, always, there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, that sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. When we last left the Davao escape party, the end was in sight. They had nothing left. They had done their best, their very best. But now they were defeated. The undying ember of hope, that instinct for survival that kept them alive on Bataan, that determination that saw them through O'Donnell, that constant belief in the future that sustained them in Kabanatuan, that resiliency that led them to risk death to escape Depakol, none of it remained. They were defeated. The minutes dragged on. No one spoke. No one knew what to say. Until Sam, it was Commander McCoy. "Sam," he asked, "you're a Catholic. Suppose you could lead us in a prayer?" Sam Gratio slipped off the platform and fell to his knees. "A prayer? What prayer? What would be the most appropriate supplication for a situation as desperate as this, when everything was stacked against them and all hope was lost?" He closed his eyes and thought back to his childhood, his boyhood friends, his first Holy Communion, to the first prayers he learned from the nuns at St. Aloysius back in Spokane. There was a prayer for just such a situation. It was his favorite prayer. "Remember," he began slowly, "O most gracious Virgin Mary." He looked at the others and nodded encouragement. To a man, they understood, repeating the words after him. That never was it known. Line by line, they joined in, repeating the prayer. Never was it known that anyone who fled to thy protection, implored thy help, or sought thine intercession was left unaided. They continued on, and with each line, they found their spirits lifted, their strength growing, their determination and resolve returning. "Despise not our petitions, but in thy mercy hear and answer us. Amen." With that last amen, something changed. No, everything changed. The all-consuming sense of despair and defeat was gone, and in its place, complete serenity. They all felt it. They felt a new presence in their ranks. It was something they would remember for the rest of their lives. Years, decades later, they would recall that moment with tears in their eyes and a tremble in their throat. They had witnessed a miracle. It was not a bolt of lightning, not a thunderclap, not a shining light from heaven, but it was every bit as profound and tangible and real. The Virgin had heard their plea for help. Mary had come to rescue them. Our Lady was with them. That night, they slept for more than 10 hours. They awoke the next morning refreshed and ready. McCoy suddenly realized he no longer felt any symptoms of the malady that afflicted him the day before. After a breakfast of oatmeal and tea, they continued on their way. Their path was just as difficult, but there was none of the despondency and doubt that weighed them down a day earlier. Step by step, they advanced, ever closer to their goal. At last, in the middle of the afternoon, they reached the railroad line through the jungle. They were still far from their final goal of Australia, and ultimately home, back in the U.S. They proceeded along the railroad tracks, eventually encountering the Filipino guerrilla forces in the village of Lungaog. The guerrillas were initially wary, suspecting them of being spies. Nobody believed their story. The guerrilla leader, Sergeant Cassiano de Juan, grilled them over and over. "Where are you from?" "We escaped from Depakol." "How did you get here?" Through the swamp. "Ah, sigi, sigi. So, how did you really get here?" "I told you, through the swamp." Schaffner was getting exasperated. Why don't you believe us? We've established that we're American soldiers. You've seen our dog tags. Dewan just shook his head in amazement. Nobody goes into the swamp, he said, and nobody comes out alive. With the assistance of the Filipino guerrillas, the escapees finally succeeded in contacting General Douglas MacArthur's headquarters in Australia, ultimately resulting in rescue by submarine. But that is another story. Our story concludes with reflections on the heroism of these brave men and their determination and perseverance in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds. They never gave up hope. And when they did at last find that hope reduced to a sputtering flame, it was prayer that revived that hope and restored their courage to soldier on. It is often said that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Well, we are certainly repeating history now, and not the good parts of it either. Authoritarianism and tyranny plagued much of the 20th century in the form of communism, Nazism, and Japanese imperialism, evils that these men of the greatest generation confronted and defeated. But since our ancient adversary, the devil, continues to prey on mankind like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour, these evils were never fully eradicated. And the fault does not lie entirely with Satan, but also with man himself. Ours is a fallen nature due to original sin, and so we carry its effects within us. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn observed, the line between good and evil runs not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart. It should not be surprising, then, that we have carried the evils of the 20th century with us like a persistent infection into the 21st. Not yet to the extent of those horrors of the past, at least not as far as the physical aspects of global war. But today again, we see authoritarianism and tyranny on the rise under the guise of public health and the ruse of climate change. It is a much subtler form of tyranny, and one that therefore requires greater vigilance. After all, when a U.S. senator suggests prosecuting climate change heretics, well, that's just a step away from boxcars and concentration camps. And we're just a step away from extermination camps when a Canadian prime minister openly asserts, with regard to those who did not go along with the COVID narrative, we have to make a choice. Do we tolerate these people? Do we tolerate these people? Let that sink in. In St. Peter's first epistle, where he compares the devil to a roaring lion, he teaches us to draw strength from each other. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same suffering befalls your brethren all over the world. And, we might add, all throughout time. The cycle of history repeats. Thus, we can stand in solidarity with these brave men who fought and bled and died for freedom 80 years ago and draw strength from their heroism and courage. It has been said that hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. We need strong men for these times, men with the strength of those brave soldiers who faced the horrors of a prisoner of war camp and survived. We must defeat the authoritarianism of today. We too must fight for freedom, for it is our God-given right of freedom that gives us the ability to practice our faith in its fullness. Freedom is the bulwark that preserves good order and harmony in a society and protects it from the chaos and conflict that would otherwise reign if we let our guard down. But it is also a fragile thing, as Ronald Reagan said, and never more than one generation from extinction. It is not ours by way of inheritance. It must be fought for and defended constantly by each generation, for it comes only once to a people. And those in world history who have known freedom and then lost it have never known it again. In May 1995, Sam Gracio was interviewed by Spokane Public TV station KSPS for a program entitled Northwest Profiles, where he recounted his imprisonment and escape in World War II. He reflected how the desire for freedom was so central to their lives that they were willing to risk death to regain it. When we left, of course, freedom was foremost in our mind. You know, a person doesn't realize how important freedom is until you lose it. Yes, the greatest lessons we can draw from the story of these courageous men who survived Bataan, O'Donnell, Gabanatuan, and Depakal was how much they learned to value their God-given right of freedom and how we too must defend freedom for ourselves, for our children, and for generations to come. We must never let anyone take away our freedom because of the greater good. Freedom is the greater good. Sam Gratio, a son of Spokane, a true American hero, passed away on October 3rd, 1999, and rests now at Holy Cross Cemetery, less than 4 miles from here. This talk is dedicated to his memory. Thank you.